These are the tools activists need. How can we calculate it? What motivates them? Why do people spend money? Understand the basics.
After a fantastic weekend at the Sustainable Living Festival, this week's show is chock full of insights into the sort of characters you meet at such a festival. Also, the 3CR subscriber drive. It's your turn to support the renegade economists, the public airwaves, and most of all, the hard work at 3CR. Yes, what a fantastic weekend it was. Tens of thousands of people at Fed Square, all the cutting-edge NGOs there talking about how a sustainable future is possible. And Earthsharing Australia was there in full effect. It was fantastic to meet just so many keyed-up people who really had some great insights there onto what's going on out there. We know that, you know that, but isn't it good to all come together and meet those sort of random types that you don't often have the opportunity to bump into. So, today we've got a number of interviews with, both some experts and just stallholders and interesting storytellers. So, sit back and consider how an Earth Rights democracy can assist our push towards a carbon neutral future, to one where it's actually easy being sustainable. It's not the huge killer problem that we're told it is at the moment. Our economic policies, of course, are to implement an earth-based economic system, was how someone summarized it to me over the weekend. I said, geez, why haven't I thought of that before? Thanks, Armadis from the Village Well. And that's what it's all about, is including the earth in every single decision we do. And from that, businessmen can enjoy lower taxes. The Greens can enjoy greater resource efficiency, less speculative hoarding. And from this, the dividend, society's dividend, is through all those efficiencies from the removal of 125 taxes. What can happen is we can have an extra $1 trillion a year. Yes, $1 trillion a year in extra GDP. Hopefully the majority of that growth is in the green economic sector. And from this extra GDP, we can write off taxes, we can pay citizens' dividends, or we could invest $300 billion in the crucial climate infrastructure we need, the offshore wind turbines, the biochar subsidies, the ecosystem services payments. All of those are possible under this system. Today, we're going to hear from property valuer Jeremy McCartan. We're going to hear from a fantastic Iranian guy, Pirani, who we met, and he tells an interesting story. But we're going to start off with just a young woman who must have saved up heaps of bickies to get her stall together. And here she is.
My name is Ying, and I'm running the CD DVD recycling project. So it's about educating the public about that you can recycle CDs. It is 98% recyclable, and there's currently not a lot of services out there that collects these CDs to be recycled, and it can be made into new CDs and fences, posts, sporting equipment, car parts. Hoping to start a program here in Melbourne. So I have a program a bit like the mobile phones, where there's drop-off boxes in shopping centres, retail stores, council buildings, and places like that.
You can check that out at gramdestruction.com.au.
Caramob is a concept that started off in the US, and the concept is we all shop, but we don't organise the way we shop. So if we can all organise the way we shop and the time and the place, we can all use our dollar to address environmental issues and social issues as well. So we're going to hold a event in March in Burundar. So at the moment, we've gone around to local grocery stores in Burundar and saying to them, In 2 weeks' time, if we bring a whole mob of consumers to your store and shop and you make all these profit and you get free publicity, and yeah, so how much of the profit from that carrot mob event would you contribute to energy efficiency, waste disposal, or having organics fair tracing in your shop? Now, whichever business contributes the highest percentage of profit they make from the carrot mob event will get the mob of consumers to their store. So we are having an event in March. There are 52 carrot mobs all over the world. There's one in Sydney and we're starting one up in Melbourne. It's fantastic. It's a good concept and everyone should get involved. Thank you.
Yay! And those two websites there, if you want to recycle CDs, it is gramdestruction.com.au, gramdestruction.com.au. You can even post them in the mail to recycle your CDs or DVDs. And melbourne.carrotmob.org. That's melbourne.carrotmob.org. If you want to join together and use your dollar as your voting power. Another random Sustainable Living Festival interview. We're hearing some interesting stories about South Africa and public housing.
Yep.
And your name, my friend?
Paul Fleckney. I'm a student at Melbourne University studying urban planning. We were just discussing before, Kyle and I, about the provision of social housing and public housing in South Africa. What's happened over the last, 10, 15 years since the fall of apartheid is that the government took on a real priority to provide housing and actually mandated it into the constitution to say that everyone must have a house. So it's actually part of the constitution now that, you know, that the government is responsible for providing housing.
Yeah.
But unfortunately what they've done, Carl, is that, you know, they've divided the accountability between different layers of government. So what has tended to happen is that, you know, you might have one layer of government provides a house, but they don't provide any infrastructure for the house. And then another layer of government has to provide the infrastructure, and the two aren't coordinating, and sometimes they don't really know who's responsible for doing what. So what ends up happening is you get two outcomes generally. One is you get these houses that no one lives in because, you know, they don't have infrastructure connected, or you get these civil unrest and social unrest and protests from people who basically, you know, complaining about the fact they've got no water, no electricity, and nothing like that, etc., etc.
One of the other issues that happens with a lot of social housing is that one generation gets new products and then they get trashed or they get worn down over time, and then there's nobody wants to live there, or there's no finance to refresh what's there.
And that's actually, it's interesting that, because in India that's quite often the case. So what has happened a lot in India is, and I'm like, by no means I'm an expert on this, but I mean this is just something that, you know, from what I've read and what I've learned. But there are areas where they have tried to rehouse slum dwellers into new housing, and I think more anecdotal than real empirical evidence, but what has happened on occasion apparently is that, you know, these people who have been rehoused have decided that they would, you know, make more money by subletting, renting, or selling the place that they were given. And, you know, ultimately what has happened in some of those cases, those places have sort of gone to rack and ruin because they weren't there to look after them. I don't know how prevalent that is and, you know, whether that's really a significant trend or not, but I'm sure, you know, that kind of thing does happen in the world. And that is always kind of the moral hazard, I think, of providing free housing. You know, you are giving someone an asset. When you think about it, you know, does it make sense to give people free assets that they can then sell? Or should we be really just giving them the tenure, you know, the secure tenure that they can live somewhere, but, you know, on conditions that they can't then sell it on? I don't know. That's maybe something to look at.
The concept we go with on this micro scale is a community land trust where people can buy the house for approximately $80,000 to $100,000, but they pay a yearly land rent back to the government. And from that, it means that the housing, there's a public-private interest there between the two, and the rent back to the government can finance additional affordable housing.
And would it also finance the infrastructure maintenance and things like that as well, I presume, like the water, electricity maintenance? Is that the idea?
Well, the council rates would do that.
Okay, so it's in addition to rates?
Yeah, okay, that's
so it's
right.
It's an additional tax to rates as well, you're proposing.
Yeah. But what that is, that $10,000 they pay a year is what would make up the $250,000, $300,000 $350,000 people are borrowing these days just for the land location, and paying an interest on that to the banks, and that's what's hurting so much. So we've got to get rid of that interest to the banks, and we've got to build that nexus between public and private and get it working in a loop rather than against each other, which is what seems to happen so much.
I suppose it's about making it fair for everyone, right, in terms of at this stage, you know, certainly here in Australia, the odds are too much stacked against the individual in terms of purchasing a house, particularly here in Victoria, so probably more so than anywhere. And, you know, if you can redress some of that balance so that the individual and the banks are kind of on equal parity, perhaps that's really where we need to be going.
As my twins, day 31 at their first festival, Awaken, we better wrap it up there. Thank you very much, Carl.
Cheers. Thank you.
At the SLF, and we've bumped into my old childhood neighbour, Jeremy McCartan, who is a property valuer. Now, Jeremy, the issue of property valuations is a very controversial one. How does this play out when you're out on the streets looking at properties and how they're working?
Well, the valuation system is based on market activity. So a valuer is valuing a particular property. They will look at comparable sales of similar properties in order to provide their estimate of value for that property. And I guess where it can become difficult in situations like we had in 2009, when the market starts to rise, the value estimate can very quickly become difficult because people are paying big prices at auctions. And when the valuer looks at a collection of sales and says, well, you know, how do we support this valuation? Based on other sales, the property's not worth that much.
Right, and so you've got to figure out some way to average, because generally most municipalities are biannual valuations, so that adds that layer of complexity and controversy to your work.
Yeah, well, I am a municipal valuer, and the councils do rate every 2 years. The rating valuation date is the 1st of January on the even year, so there's actually a revaluation going on in Melbourne at the moment across all the councils. And speaking to people in, you know, late 2008, there probably would have been an expectation that the values would go down, but there seems to be a movement back in the market up in an upward direction again. And I think that'll be very interesting to see how that's interpreted by the community. Of course, the other issue with rating is you do have to look at the two sides. There's the valuation, which is just a method of apportionment, and then there's the actual council rate in the dollar, which the councils determine themselves through their own internal budget process. But there's no doubt it's an area where people are taking a lot of interest because of the general interest in real estate and property, and can you make a quick buck?
Yes, well, that quick dollar is extenuated through the upkick in land prices all the time. And what percentage of the average house value would you see in the areas you survey as between land and the improvements, the building upon them?
Well, you know, in most areas in Melbourne, I think, generally speaking, and certainly in the inner suburbs, the land value of a lot of properties is 80%+ of the total value of the property. Now, that probably moves out to 60% perhaps in the more far-flung suburbs, and then in new housing estates, it probably balances a little bit more towards the house being worth a bit more than the land. But I mean, on the fringe, that's where the cheap land is, if you can call it cheap, Carl. I guess a couple of hundred thousand, or now blocks even in those areas are up around sort of the mid-200s, and people will spend another couple of hundred thousand, 250,000 to build the house. But in the inner suburbs, there's no doubt that the growth in value of your inner areas has been caused by land being a finite resource in terms of it's just not available, and there's increasing demand for it, and that's what's driven the improvements to the point where a lot of the time the improvements add no value to the property at all.
That's right, and it's really just a matter of timing as to how much profit these guys can make. There's no real skill in it at all, is there?
No. There is very little skill a lot of the time. Of course, we see, because we do municipal valuations and we see properties selling and reselling, we certainly see people lose money from real estate. I don't think there's any truth in the idea that you will always make money from property. It is just simply not true. But I guess a lot of the time when people do lose money, it is just about timing. So they've bought at a particular point in the market, and then they've had to sell for some other perhaps external reason at a time in the market when the conditions haven't been favourable. but it really is, it can be a real no-brainer. And in a way, it's, you know, I don't think it's particularly, I can't think of an expression, Carl, to describe it sometimes. It just seems, sometimes the people who come along and buy the property subsequently, you just think they must be, you know, there must be an issue with them just not researching the market or anything like that. A house will be renovated, a 1960s brick veneer house in Doncaster will be renovated and the polished floorboards and a nice kitchen. And suddenly it's selling, you know, it was selling for $650,000 and it sells for $875,000. And the renovators probably spent $50,000 to $100,000 on that renovation. And it's tax-free capital gains if it's the principal place of residence. It's madness.
How often when you do a property valuation are there protests about the value? So any ratepayer can protest the valuation. How does that provide some... You know, it must cause complexity in your world.
Oh, yeah. Look, the system provides the ratepayer with a right to object every year within 60 days of getting their rate notice. And that's a perfectly legitimate and reasonable statutory right that everybody should have. You can also object to your valuation if the council changes it for another reason, like if you did a renovation or something. But bear in mind, the valuation objection... The valuer will just refer back to the sales that occurred around the date of his or her valuation. So in January 2010, for example, we'll be reflecting the market at that time. I think the average ratepayer can ring the council. They can usually speak to the valuer, maybe not immediately, but certainly they'll be called back by the valuer. Valuer will discuss sales evidence with them. Sometimes the ratepayer's had a valuation done or they've had agents through and they have a differing opinion. The whole system is a mass appraisal system. So it's based on historical data that's built up over time. It's not always going to be possible to fully pick up, you know, the depreciation of a house if it's in poor condition. But also, likewise, sometimes you can't always pick up when houses have been renovated or anything until they sell for that, you know, in that example before. So I think the other issue, though, is that the larger properties, the shopping centres and the large office buildings and so forth, people may not be aware that a lot of the time they are retaining valuers who review the valuation, who object quite frequently. I have to be honest and say a lot of the time that is land tax driven, maybe rather than the council rate driven, because the land tax system, it's probably another whole other discussion, but the land tax system certainly, a very large property will pay tens or not, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in land tax a year. And their only recourse really to maybe get that bill down, whether you agree with it or not, is to continually object to the council, which then the council has to devote resources and so forth to trying to resolve that objection. So the objection process for the householder, I think, is you know, pretty localised and pretty easy. And you know, the valuer will usually talk to you, and there's a right of appeal at VCAT if you feel that it's not satisfactory. I think for the larger corporates, it tends to be a very time-consuming and resource-involved process for councils. When they're providing valuations for the state government, which doesn't really get involved in sort of managing the problem of what happens when they actually object.
And do these big developers come and thank the local council when they improve the road network nearby and things like that? Now, back to... evaluation and depreciation. Now, land price appreciates and housing depreciates. How often does the depreciation take over, and is there a general rule of thumb for the rate of a house to depreciate?
Oh, no, Carl, I don't think there is a rule of thumb. I think for us, what we do is always rooted in the sales activity that occurs in the marketplace. If you went back to the 1950s and the attitude that people had towards Victorian or Edwardian houses at that time, people would have said that they weren't very valuable at all. But now, because of their relative scarcity, even unrenovated Victorian or Edwardian houses in suburbs like Hawthorne are very highly prized. And now it's more like the belts of 1940s and 50s weatherboard and brick veneer houses are not very highly sought after. So there aren't any rules about depreciation. It's the particular area at the particular time. I've worked over the years for Burundara and in Ballwin and in those areas. There's very few weatherboard houses left in those suburbs now. The whole character of our suburbia has changed from, you know, a lot of areas had a general mixture of brick and weatherboard houses. the weatherboard houses are largely gone in a lot of areas. That kind of dynamic, interesting streetscape has just been replaced by, you know, 40 square, fairly ugly McMansions. And even now in some of the inner suburbs, a post-war brick home, it doesn't have any value. All the value is in the land.
And there we are at the Sustainable Living Festival. All right, listeners, want you to call up and support 3CR, 94198377. That's 94198377. Become a subscriber of this fantastic radio station and go on the running to win a Renegade Economist Highlights disc. Yes, we're building up the highlights, and you will also go on the running for a book by Alana Hartsock, The Earth Belongs to Everyone, doesn't it? So, and to round it out, there's a subscription to our Progress magazine where you can get the latest Earth Rights-based information on cane-based paper printed with veggie inks. And so, of course, just after we finished that interview with Jeremy, he went on to tell me how in Roeville back in the 50s, for example, when that was as far as the city had expanded, property developers then would, who just received a rezoning, would auction that land. But they would auction 400 sites at once. That's 400 places where people could buy a piece of land to build their dream house on. And he went on then to say that in today, that instead of just having one lot with 400 sites on it, you'll get up to lot 87 with 12 sites on it. And this is a prime example of land being drip-fed to the market, and that's what we constantly talk about on this show. And yeah, unfortunately, it was that magic that appears after you press stop on the machine. But great to speak to Jeremy. We're going to now slide along a little bit, and soon we'll be hearing from our buddy from Iran, Priya. You're listening to the Renegade Economists. Call now. Support this show. And we have Puya online here, and he's going to give us a rundown what's going on in Iran and a bit of history behind various revolutions. And, yeah, I must say, it's great to meet a happy traveller cruising around Australia. Tell us about Iran and what's going on at the moment.
Basically, at the moment, there is a government which we believe have rigged the elections, and at the same time there is an opposition which they are the main figures of people who made the revolution happen, and they're standing up against the government saying that the way that we're reacting toward the foreign politics and economics, it's wrong. A couple of months ago it was the presidential election. The current president at power, we believe they rigged the election and won the power back. And now it's around 6 months that basically on each main day of our calendar, people are going on the streets where they green signs showing that they're not happy with this government and they want their votes back. But unfortunately, the government is fighting back with the power of gun and jail. That's what I hear from the news of friends back home, that the jails are so full that they're keeping people in vans just to keep that environment closed so no one can actually say anything. But the good thing is more than 70% of Iran population are young generation, and they don't accept this anymore. So they're trying to get something back. Hopefully, I hope they reach something soon.
It's phenomenal. We were watching a unbelievable vodcast that comes out of Vancouver called submedia.tv, and he was showing footage from Iran over the last week or two of all sorts of cars on fire, and actually the people stopping executions, you know, like they stormed this area and cut people off the rope and beat the cops back. And I was just like, that is a real revolution. I mean, is it like really that sort of vibe on the streets?
Yeah, it is. Like 30 years ago when the revolution happened, the main guy in charge, he had this theory that if we have public days that people go on the street and show their unity, the government wouldn't get corrupted. So now we have some certain days during the calendar that it's everyone's thing to go out and show their unity. It used to be a religious governmental thing back years, but now people are using that to fight back because government is not approving the protest. They're not letting them protest. So they're using those days to go out and show their things. And another thing which was really beautiful, I didn't expect that from my society.
Itchy, a bit scratchy and go, ooh, what should we do? Now, tell me about the economics of Iran. How's it been going with it? Because it has been some opening up of your economy.
No, it is getting more private now. So there are more private organizations. And back in President Khatami's time, before Ahmadinejad, he was the main figure that started this private organization trying to allocate the government's power to more smaller companies to make everyone involved. But during the past 4 years of Mr. Ahmadinejad's presidency, it's been on papers that economics have gone back 20 years. We came out of an 8-year war and our economy was still in a higher average of the table. And we were developing well. Like the first president after the war, President Rafsanjani, he made the economy well-based. The society was still a bit dark. And the next 8 years of the next president, Khatami, the economy was based and he started developing the society out of that strict situation that it was. And he succeeded heaps. But unfortunately, and we did it to ourselves, 4 years ago, they nominated 4 candidates for presidential election. They were all bad. So we boycotted the election. None of us voted.
Really?
And Ahmadinejad got elected.
So are the young people really getting into politics and economics now, are they?
Yeah, in Iran, when you go on street, everyone is talking about politics and economics. You sit in a taxi, everyone is talking about politics and economics.
Brilliant. And what's happening with all your oil money? Where's all that ending up?
Oh, in corrupted governmental figures.
It's the same all around the world, isn't it? It's, you know, maybe in Australia we don't know so much about that, but we're still wondering whether instead of it being illegal, bribery and stuff, illegal corruption, it's maybe legalized corruption in campaign contributions to the political parties for all of their election costs. So, yes, it must be, it must be a sense of hope, though, in Iran with the people actually awake. At least you must have one of the few countries in the world where the people are awake.
Yeah. When I came out of Iran 1.5 years ago, the main talk that we had with all friends that what can be the solution to get out of this situation was such a thing to happen, but we were expecting it to happen in 20 years. So a few months ago when I heard that have happened, it is sad that people are getting killed and busted on the street, but that's the thing that we needed. These people are making sacrifices and we are thankful to them. I'm sad that I can't be there, and if I was there, I will be on the streets as well. And toward that point that you make toward Western societies, I went to Woodford last year and I went this year as well. And it's the sense of the government trying to control this was heaps more sensible in this year compared to last year. And we had this conversation with heaps of people. Me as a person who grew up in a strict society in Iran, we always have this fancy dream of Western societies being absolutely free and everything. But since I came here and get involved a bit with Western society type of living, I believe if this society continues on the way that it goes, in 20 years, 30 years, we're all going to be like Islamic Republic of Iran.